For the last few weeks, we've been in a series entitled The 7 Number One Reasons. Each week, we're going to deal with a specific reason that Jesus came. If we were to pass around a microphone on a Sunday morning and ask people to answer the question, why did Jesus come, you'd have this person saying, well, he came for this reason, and then another person saying, well, he came for this reason. And at first, they'd sound contradictory, but they're not. They're complementary. That's how the New Testament paints Jesus. If it's one person speaking about Jesus, he'll say that, no, Jesus came for this reason. But somebody else to a different group of people will give another reason entirely. So Jesus to one group of people says, don't think I came to abolish the law and the prophets, to do away with the scriptures. I didn't come to do that. I came to fulfill them. But to another person, he says, I came to testify to the truth. That is why I came. Somebody else says the reason Jesus came, the reason the Son of God came, is to destroy the work of the devil. They're all complementary ideas, different facets of Jesus's mission. Today we're going to deal with one particular text in the book of John, and it says that here is why I came. In John chapter 10, verse 10, he says, the thief has come to steal and to kill and destroy, but I have come that they may have life. Another translation of the text says, I have come to provide the best life possible, the life abundant. So you think about Jesus coming, you know, why did Jesus come? Many of us, we hold in our minds, well, the reason that Jesus came was to take something, to make demands on us. That's the only reason he would show up, is to tell us that he wants something from us. But Jesus says, no, the reason I have come is because I want something for you. I want to give you something, not trade, not negotiate. I want to give you something, and not a small something. I want to give you life, the best imaginable life. And it's interesting, he's contrasting it with the thief. He says the thief comes to steal, to kill, destroy, to take. It's really easy to say, oh, well, he's talking about the devil. That's the thief, right? The big bad devil. Well, maybe by extension, that's what he's talking about. But in the context, in John chapter 10, for a couple of chapters up to that point, the whole issue is the man born blind that Jesus heals, and this whole inquisition starts about, well, how does this blind man suddenly have the ability to see? Wasn't he a sinner? Doesn't he know his place in the hierarchy? And so Jesus is talking about systems that take from people, that put burdens on people, that expect more from people than they provide for. Jesus is talking not just simply about the bad guy. He's talking about that impulse that exists in religion or in people that want to take more than they want to give. And Jesus says, that's why the thief came, but I came to give the best life possible. This is salvation. Jesus wants to help us step into life, to really, really live our lives, that on our insides we would recognize what life is. As a community, as families, as co-workers and students, classmates, all that we would understand that life is always being offered to us. And so Jesus, in the context of John chapter 10, says, here's why I came, that you could really live, and I want to give you that life. So a few weeks ago, we as a staff, we watched a woman speak by the name of Dr. Brené Brown from the University of Houston, and she gave a very short talk, and when it was over, the conversation that we had about what this meant for our lives and what it had to do with how we think in our own internal dialogue, and then how we communicate with each other, how we see each other. It was a great conversation, and part of that conversation was our community has to see this. Our community has to experience what we've just experienced. This is really important information for understanding what stands between us and life, what stands in between us and accepting Jesus' offer to live the best life possible. And so today is a little bit different as we watch Dr. Brené Brown walk us through one facet of what it would mean to really live. And so we hope that you enjoy it.
So I'm going to start by walking you into a scene in a movie, and then I want y'all to tell me what happens next. Okay, here's my black. Christmas Eve. Beautiful night, light snowfall. Young family of four in the car on the way to Grandma's house for dinner. They're listening to the radio station, the one that starts playing the Christmas music like right at Halloween. Jingle Bells comes on, the kids in the back seat go crazy. Everyone breaks into song. The camera pans in on the faces of the kids, the mom, dad. What happens next? Car crash. 60% of people say car crash. 60%. Another 10 to 15% have equally fatalistic answers, but more creative. I have the camera cuts to the oncologist who is looking at the bad news that he's going to share the day after Christmas. I have, they get to grandmother's house, everyone's dead, a serial killer's on the loose. And I had one dude who worked in a shark attack. I did. What's interesting to me about this, and it's an indictment a little bit of the media, which I wouldn't so much care about, except that I'm a vulnerability researcher, and I've spent the last 10 years studying vulnerability, and I cannot tell you how many hundreds and hundreds of stories that I've collected from people who that is their response, not just to media, but in their real lives. How many parents I've interviewed who will say, and I'm looking at my children, and they're sleeping, and I'm on this, just the verge of bliss, and I picture something horrible happening. Do you know this? Yes. I get the promotion, and I get to fly up to headquarters, to find out about my new job and what's going to happen. Plane crashes. The fatalistic response is not universal. We're not all like that. But it is a symptom of an issue that is both universal and, I believe, profoundly dangerous. And that is, we are losing our tolerance for vulnerability. And in our culture, what do we think is synonymous with vulnerability? Weakness. You are an excellent audience. It's almost as if I trained you. It's perfect. Weakness. And I'm going to talk about how that's not the case tonight. Vulnerability is absolutely at the core of fear and anxiety and shame and very difficult emotions that we all experience. But vulnerability is also the birthplace of joy, of love, of belonging, of creativity, of faith. And so it becomes very problematic when, as a culture, we lose our capacity to be vulnerable. So this kind of fatalistic car crash is a symptom. I refer to it as foreboding joy. One of the symptoms that we're losing our capacity for vulnerability is that joy actually becomes foreboding. Something good happens, or we're looking at someone we love, or we're thinking about something we care about, and then we become compelled to beat vulnerability to the punch. Other symptoms. Disappointment as a lifestyle. It is much easier to live disappointed than it is to feel disappointment. And so this is the person in the after school movie that's, I don't want to play your stupid game because it's dumb and boring, and because really maybe nobody will ask me. We sidestep getting excited about something because we're not sure it's actually going to happen. Low-grade disconnection is another symptom of vulnerability avoidance. We go through the motions. It's like low-grade fever. It may not kill us, but it keeps us pretty miserable. Perfection is one of I call it the 200-pound shield. How can anything go wrong if my life looks like an ad? I'm going to perform and please and make sure everything's perfect. And perfectionism has nothing to do with striving for excellence and healthy. It's nothing to do with healthy striving. People who I interview who are absolutely accomplished and people who strive for excellence are the biggest negotiators and compromisers that I've ever interviewed. Perfection is a tool to protect ourselves. Extremism. There's a very simple equation. Faith minus vulnerability equals extremism. Faith is the vulnerability that flows between the shores of certainty. Faith without vulnerability. Spirituality is inherently vulnerable. It is believing in things we don't understand or really can't see. And last, I believe the most universal way that we are dealing with an intolerance for vulnerability in our culture is that we numb. And I'll talk about this in a minute. Let's go to a bigger question, and that is, what is driving this intolerance for vulnerability in us? And I believe the answer is scarcity. We live in a culture that tells us that there is never enough, that we are not enough, that we are not good enough, that we are not safe enough, that we can never be certain enough, that we're not perfect enough. And maybe the one that we really don't talk about that I think is perhaps the most dangerous is that we are not extraordinary enough. In this world, somehow an ordinary life has become synonymous with a meaningless life. And so often we are missing what is truly important because we're on the quest for what is extraordinary. Not understanding that in our ordinary lives, in the ordinary moments of our lives, is really where we can find the most joy. One of the things that happens, I think, in our culture of scarcity is that we are constantly collecting images and messages and experiences. I think it's unconscious. I really don't think that we're aware of how many messages and images of scarcity that we collect every day. And I want to tell a story about something that happened about 6 months ago that I think really illustrates this. So I have to catch a flight to go do a talk somewhere. And my daughter's, I have a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old, and my daughter's really struggling with a school project. I am definitely in the scarcity mode. I shouldn't be going. I'm not a good enough mom. I can't balance all of this. I have to go to my bank, which is inside of a grocery store, which is, I don't know if that happens here, but in Texas, all the banks have moved inside the grocery stores. So I walk up to the grocery store sliding glass doors, and there's a big Code Adam sticker, if you don't know what that is, it's an incredibly important program, but it's a program that says this store and its employees are trained that when a child is gone missing or nabbed, everything in the store shuts down. So I look at that and I think, oh God, okay, just stay focused, Brene. No one's going to nab your kids while you're away. I go and get my money, I get back in the car, I get on the freeway toward the airport, and I pass the Amber Alert. Keep driving, Brene, keep driving. About 2 miles past the Amber Alert, there's a sign that tells me that 39 people have been killed on that specific stretch of highway. And please wear my seatbelt. Then I get to the airport, and of course, I'm in line to security, getting naked, and I hear, the threat code has been moved to orange. And then I go through this thing that I'm like, oh my God, holy crap, is that a movement? Is it always orange? I was like, I'm going to start writing it on my hand on a Sharpie. Like, it's always orange. Okay, orange is not, it hasn't gone bad. I'm like, what is it? Okay, so I'm like, orange. Okay, it's orange. I think it was orange yesterday. Maybe something's happened, and I was busy reading the Amber Alert, then trying to find the license plate. So I get to my gate, and I sit down, and they're like, do not leave unintended baggage, And I look down, and there's a bag. And I'm like, oh, my God. Wait, it's a diaper bag. And I know that mother is, like, 10 feet away chasing her kid, and I'm like, but I saw this on Law & Order. And I'm going to board that plane, and then the next thing you're going to hear is, ching, ching, that Law & Order ching. Ding, ding. And then we're blow up. So I get on the plane, and I'm really getting ready to start. I'm in kind of what you would call, I would say, an anxiety attack. So I'm having an anxiety attack, and the guy comes in. I'm flying in business class, and the guy comes in. He's sitting next to me. He turned out to be a supply chain manager consultant. And so he looks over, and he's like, you okay? I'm like, I'm good. Yeah, what's up? And my phone rings, and my son's face pops up. Well, he's 5, so that means his school's calling. Hello? Charlie's got a fever. Can you come get him? So I'm like, I text my husband, I take care of it. And the guy next to me said, really, are you okay? by this time, you know, the cabin doors are closed. And I said, you know what? I'm good. But I'm having that thing where I can't decide whether my gut is really saying get off the flight, something's going to happen, or I'm just freaking out. And I'm trying to figure out how to do something crazy enough to get off the flight, but to not end up on the no-fly list. And so this, I mean, yeah, I'm a super blast to fly with. Yeah. So then he said, let me get you a drink. And I said, you know, I don't drink. And he goes, Xanax? And I was like, no, I don't do Xanax either. Which is a shame. But I don't. But then what I realize is it really makes me think about my work. Because we numb vulnerability. Now, had he said chips and queso, that would have been a completely different issue. Evidence of the numbing. We are the most addicted. We are the most medicated, obese, and in debt adult cohort in human history. We're numbing. And this doesn't even include busyness. I didn't even put the busy slide up. You know, when they start having busy recovery meetings, they'll have to, you know, busy 12-step meetings, they'll have to rent out football stadiums. Because we just stay so busy that the truth of our lives can't catch up. That's the plan. And so what are the consequences of numbing vulnerability? What are the consequences of trying to beat vulnerability to the punch? Here's the consequence to numbing that I've learned. You know, and I'm, as a vulnerability researcher, I've spent the first 6 years of my research studying shame, empathy, and courage, and the last 4 years studying joy, authenticity, love, and belonging. And one of the things that I learned that was very startling for me personally and everyone I've ever met is that you cannot selectively numb emotion. When we numb the dark emotion, when we numb vulnerability and fear and shame of not being good enough, we by default numb joy. We cannot selectively just numb the dark emotions. We have interesting research around this. We have research that shows us in addiction studies that an intensely positive experience is as likely to trigger relapse as an intensely negative experience. Let me tell you, if vulnerability is a sharp edge, there may be nothing sharper than joy. To let yourself soften into loving someone, to caring about something passionately, that's vulnerable. So the question becomes, how do we embrace vulnerability? And here's what I learned from the research. We practice gratitude. We stop and be thankful for what we have. I've interviewed a lot of people who have been through many horrific things, from genocide to trauma. And when you ask them what they need, they will tell you, I don't need your pity, I don't need your sympathy. I need, when you look at your children, I need to know you're grateful. I need you to know that you know what you have. So to practice gratitude, to honor what's ordinary about our lives, because that is what's truly extraordinary. We can compete with the images from the media, from the news, from the scary shows on TV, with our own images of gratitude about what's ordinary in our lives, the people we love, our kids, our family, play, our community, and nature. These are things that happen every single day that we're so busy being afraid we're missing these. So that's, I think, the biggest thing is to be grateful for what we have, to honor what's ordinary. And last, I just want to say that, and I'm a parent and I'm a vulnerable person too, but I really believe, you know, we want more guarantees. We want to believe we're not going to get hurt and that bad things are not going to happen, and they are. But there is a guarantee that no one talks about that, and that is that if we don't allow ourselves to experience joy and love, we will definitely miss out on filling our reservoir with what we need when those hard things happen. And so I'll end on the note that I'm grateful for your time tonight, and I'm grateful to be here, and I hope this is something that we can do together, because I believe in vulnerability we'll find what really gives purpose and meaning to our lives.
So that's the question. Can we be people of gratitude? Can we be a people of joy? Can we be a people of peace? Or will we just continue to believe that the world is a dark, scary place that needs survived in? Do we believe that Jesus is saying, I've come to give you life, or do we believe that he's come to give us a system where we can avoid sinning and avoid darkness and avoid becoming bad boys and girls? Will we believe that life is something to be celebrated? Will we believe that life at its core is good, that goodness is already around us? That's the question. Children, they naturally believe this. Children, they very naturally, from a very early age, believe that there's more good to life, that there's more beauty, that there's more light. Jesus even says the kingdom belongs to children. I think that might be one of the reasons why. They have this optimism that we all look at and go, oh man, to be a kid again. But we also call it naive, because at one point a kid grows up, and it happens differently for all kids, but one day they stop being a kid. One day they decide, you know what, I'm not going to be vulnerable anymore. I'm not going to have joy. I'm going to wrap myself in cynicism. I'm going to wrap myself in skepticism. I'm going to wrap myself in judgmental attitudes so that I can protect myself from falling into somebody else's trap. Suddenly, you grow up and you decide that the world isn't okay at its core, that it's full of evil, and life is about avoiding that evil, that life is about going from one dark moment to the next and trying to do the best you can, but and just knowing the other shoe's going to drop any moment. But Jesus says, I've come to give you life, not just a system by which you can avoid pain. I've come to give you life. At one point later, six chapters later in John chapter 16, he says, I have told you these things so that you could have peace. You're going to have trouble in this world, but take heart, take courage. I've overcome it. I've said this to you so that you could have peace, because there's going to be trouble. Bad things are going to happen, but I've overcome that. I've come to give you life, give it to you in full measure, abundantly. So there's an old tradition some of us are maybe familiar with. Some of us, maybe it'd be a new thing. Every Sunday here at Crosspoint, we take a second and we connect with each other. We shake hands, say hi to the people in our row, the people in front, behind us. And for some of us, it's like, oh, great, here comes that moment where I have to pretend to be an extrovert. But what it's meant to be is just a short snapshot of us being a community and making sure that we know the people that we're worshiping and learning and trying to be inspired with. So today, we're going to end with that, with this, and we're going to do it a little bit differently, because we're going to mix it with this ancient tradition of the giving of peace to each other. And so I just want to invite you all right now to stand up. Yes, all of you in the back. I know it's a video, but I can see you. Stand up and just offer peace to your brothers and sisters in your row. When I say go, to offer peace to those in your row, to those that are around you, and not just to fulfill this requirement that you're being given, but to offer peace to each other as a way of saying, the world has been overcome. In this life, we're going to have trouble. But peace is a statement of joy. Peace is a statement that says we are not going to fixate on what goes wrong. We're not going to assume it's all about to fall apart at any moment. We're not going to assume that the universe is a cold, dark place and that we're on our own. And the only way to live, the only way to survive, is to get from other people what we think we're going to need. In this life, we'll have hardship, but we can have peace because Jesus has come to give us life, to give it to us in full measure, and that we're invited to be a totally different kind of community, a different kind of person, different kinds of families, co-workers, classmates, all of that. And so go ahead, offer each other peace. I'll wait.